This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and fresh from a beachside brawl, local celebrity chef and culinary icon Tiffany Faison is here with us in Studio 2. Tiffany, welcome back.
Oh, it's so nice to be here, Tiziana. Thank you.
It's great to have you, and I actually meant it. You just finished your latest Food Network show, Beachside Brawl, and it's got this kind of East Coast, West Coast competition.
Yep.
To see who does boardwalk food, beachy food the best. Tell us about it.
Little breezy, little beefy. Yeah. So it's the East Coast versus the West Coast. Brooke Williamson was the captain and mentor for the West Coast. I was captain and mentor for the East Coast. We got to choose our teams. We each had four culinary competitor chefs that came on and represented each coast. Antonio LaFaso was the host and also judge. It was from Brian Landone and Guy Fieri, who have a production company. So much fun. We actually filmed it earlier in the spring, but we just finished airing it. Spoiler alert, the East Coast does not prevail this time, but...
Yes, and we will talk about that. But yeah. I want to start. So you picked your team.
I did.
I have a question because
sure.
You have four people on the team. This mm-hmm. is the East Coast team. We have one from Cape Cod.
Mm-hmm.
We have one from New Jersey. We have two from Florida. Mm-hmm. What exactly are we calling the East Coast here?
We are calling the entire Eastern Seaboard the East Coast. So we took a liberal scoop of the Eastern Seaboard for this. You know, it's interesting because I got to choose my team, but I also had to pick from people that reached out or the casting producers found. So
I did have
a pool of people. Exactly. So I started with probably about 20 people. And there were not a lot of people from like our area, from Boston and Cape Cod. I certainly would have maybe tried to have a more robust representation. But we had a few people. I had Chef Ben, who was great, and he's from Harwich, has a restaurant in Harwich, and he did really well. All-star guy, just really sweet human being, really good cook. So I was happy to have him on my team. But I had him, Jared Brown from New Jersey. I had Jada Vidal from Florida, and then also Chef Edward Lorman from, like, he's kind of Florida, Alabama, like Pensacola area. So.
And he was the one that made it furthest.
He did. He made it the furthest. He and Jada. Jada was, like, next to last, and then Ed made it to the final with me.
Because it was a competition.
It was.
Somebody wins. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Brooke Williamson, who I know is a friend of yours.
Yes.
And I was so curious to see this because I got to go back a little bit. All right. So you bested her in the third Tournament of Champions.
Correct.
And my favorite moment still from that is when the two of you meet outside your trailer the morning of the finale. Here it is.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too.
Ready to go down?
Ready to go. Good luck to you.
Down. I said go down.
No.
So I have to admit, I could not throw down with somebody like that face to face, but you did. So did this have that same competitive vibe? Because this time around, Brooke comes out on top. Last time, you clearly did.
Yeah. So it's it does have a competitive vibe. We're all such competitors. It doesn't matter what you put us in. If you told us all hold hands and save the world, we'd be like, which one does it first? Like, as much as we do enjoy each other and respect each other as cooks and as people, we're so competitive. So yes, I took Brooke down in season 3 of Tournament of Champions. She came back and took my East Coast team down. Let's split hairs. I'll take the L, but, there's agreeing with it and not agreeing. I'm not contesting it, but I really am so proud of my East Coast chefs, and I think that they just did such an incredible job. We had such a really incredible team, like the camaraderie and the sense of family and helping each other and what we learned together as the East Coast team was just, it was so much fun and extraordinary and really special. Really special.
So let's talk about the food a little bit, and it may be because it's 11 a.m. and I'm hungry. But some of these recipes they had, you know, we're talking, you know, things like scallops and mm-hmm. coconut and pineapple and shrimp and then lemongrass and
sure.
What was one of your? What's like one dish that you're still fantasizing about? Like I want to eat that again.
That someone made or that I made?
That someone made.
I think about Jada's fish and chips that she made right out of the gate, and it was we all had to make like boardwalk specialties, and she did this really beautiful fish and chips with like a turmeric kind of curry battered on her fish, and then her chips were plantains with a chimichurri on top of it. And I never really thought about doing plantains as the chip. It was so lovely, and just the fish came through, the plantains were great, curry was really lovely, and then the chimichurri that she made, super bright, herbaceous, acidic. It was just really beautiful.
And I kind of can't imagine that there's any ingredient that you have never included with some other any ingredient, but did you discover from any of the chefs in this something new? I mean, like plantain chips, but where you're doing something different in your own cooking now as a result?
I learn from them all the time. And this is, I think, one of the things that such a gift about new, having new people that come into the kitchens, whether it's on a competition, whether it's in the restaurants. And it's one thing I really say to new cooks that come in. So I sometimes feel, and I remember being 100,000 years ago when I was a new cook, I remember being so intimidated by being in a kitchen and the process and thinking that you couldn't contribute, thinking that you really had to keep your head down and sort of go through all of the lessons and the ropes and never open your mouth. And that was really, you know, the culture of kitchens. But I say it all the time to new cooks that come to the kitchen that there are things that will be obvious to you that might be easier or better or combinations of flavors that we should try that you don't think that you assume that we already know. And we don't, because sometimes we're just stuck in the fallacy of tradition or we don't see the thing that's right in front of us that'll make our lives easier or whatever. So we talk about mentioning that and not being afraid to say that. Conversely, we don't make fun of or put people down for saying things that might seem a little bit obvious if we have thought of it. If we haven't, it's not like, oh, we just don't do that. We think through it, think past the answer. Does it make sense?
And do you find that that's still the culture in Boston kitchens now, the keep your head down, don't speak up, do your job, learn the ropes? Or culturally, have our kitchens started to change?
I think it's not just speaking for Boston. It's speaking for all kitchens. I think there's a mix of both. There are kitchens that have changed culturally and welcome more collaborative environments in them. And then there are some that are just keep it down, don't talk, don't, you know. And if I'm being entirely honest, there are times when I'll have younger cooks that come in, and it's about knowing when to speak up and knowing, or, you know, finding a time to say something. Like having a brand new chatty Cathy that wants to tell you how to do your job all the time when they just started cooking 5 minutes ago is not my favorite environment in a kitchen.
How do you give that feedback?
We have a little conversation that's away from like the rest of the cooks about focus and making sure that I think the best contributors are always the best listeners.
Yeah.
And then when you have something that's really burning a hole that you need to say, let's say that.
So, you know, in the arc of this conversation just now, we went from TV to cooking to being a chef. And I actually want to sort of meta talk about that arc a little bit. I've been thinking, as I've gotten to know you better, I've wondered how you balance your life as a chef and a business leader and a mentor, which you talk about a lot with your own restaurants, with your growing profile as a television personality and really a TV star. Are you finding that's an easy balance to keep? Is that tough?
No, it's totally tough. I don't think any balance is easy. When people talk about balance and what that means, I think it's, and it's not in specific to my profession or having multiple different hats that you wear. I think what I've found is, the idea of having it all, I think, is really a myth anyway. What is your all? What matters to you? Like, those are, I don't have children. I don't have, you know, I don't have that weight of my life to manage and hold. So in some ways, I don't have the commitment at home that a lot of women have. So I can kind of, you know, if I get home at 11 o'clock, midnight, 2, it doesn't matter. There's no one that's hungry that needs to be fed. And I don't have to deal with that side of my life. So that's been out of design and circumstance. But the other parts of it, putting on different hats, I think you can have parts of it at different times. I don't think you can have all of it all of the time. So it's about, for me, communicating what's happening in my life and what the priorities are at any given time. If I'm traveling and shooting a lot, then I have to communicate that to my teams, and they need to know that. And the people that support me in the business are aware of that. And then if there are times that I'm really, like, very focused on the restaurants and what we're doing and spending more time in the restaurants, then the other side of my life needs to know about that, too. I can't leave for 2 days and bounce out and shoot something that doesn't matter. And not that things don't matter, but I'm not going to go do something that's like a one-off that isn't a part of something I'm already committing to.
And is that kind of the permanent future for you, that the finding the yin and yang here? I guess what I'm asking
you just asked me about permanent future, which is a non sequitur.
I'm sorry, what?
There's no permanent future anywhere.
So, but I guess what I am asking is, which one are you, first and foremost? What's your calling?
I'm a chef. Yeah, I'm a chef first. And I think that will always remain. But your life changes, right? And it arcs and it moves in different directions. And I think sometimes, especially with chefs, there's this idea that if I'm not in my kitchens every second of the day, all the time, what is she doing? And I grew up with that, and I still hear it, not just myself, but other people were like, oh, she's not in her kitchen anymore. That chef's not in his kitchen. And there are times I'm like, guys, they've been cooking for 25 years. They don't have to be in their kitchens every second of every day. And if they are, maybe you should give more autonomy and teach better and give more to the people that work with you. So nothing is one thing forever. I am and will always be a chef. I do really enjoy this other side of my life, and it's a lot of fun. And it's not being a chef. It's just being a chef in a different way.
We're talking with local celebrity chef Tiffany Faison here in Studio 2 today. I understand. So we've been talking about this television and chef. Mm-hmm. I understand that there is a television chef, fictional, who is intriguing you right now.
Intriguing everyone.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah,
so this is this Hulu series, The Bear.
Yeah.
And it's starring, I got to look his name up, Jeremy Allen White of mm-hmm. Shameless fame. He was amazing in Shameless.
Incredible in Shameless and also incredible in this.
So why is everybody finding it so intriguing?
Well, I think different people and outlets for different reasons. And it's been very interesting to see how the world has kind of responded to this. The chef world, and I'm not going to speak for all of us, but I'll kind of speak, I will generalize because I feel like the sentiment is pretty consistent. The show got it right in a way that we haven't seen that happen yet.
Got what right?
Almost everything. The details of the kitchen, nuance of difficult leadership, a young chef that's hungry, that's in circumstances that are trying and difficult and trying to lead a team in very almost impossible circumstances, trying to be true to themselves and also do what's right sort of for the restaurant. Trying to be a leader to other cooks in the kitchen. I mean, so they got that right. They got the camaraderie in the kitchen right. They got, you watch the pastry chef in The Bear, who I think was so extraordinary. I forget what the actor's name was.
And he's a local actor, I believe.
He is. Yeah, he's incredible. Lionel Boyce stole the role as the pastry chef. And what you see in that, that I think chefs really recognize, is someone who goes from just like doing a thing to understanding that the thing can be done better and that there's a community of people out there that are doing it at a very high level, and that infects this pastry chef. And you start to see him, like, the eyes widen and he becomes really obsessed with what he's doing. And then you see the dynamics, like, you know, he starts to want to make donuts and he's talking to this young sous chef that's kind of having a similar experience about leadership and what that means for her. And you see him talk to her about, you know, can I make donuts? She knows that it's impossible. We don't have the equipment. We don't have the time. We don't really have the resources. But you don't want to kill the fire. And you just go, okay, so yes, let's give it a shot. Let's see how it goes. And then the donuts take over the kitchen. And then his normal stuff isn't getting done. Like, I've seen that happen.
You've seen this play.
I've done it. When the fire just catches hold. I loved that they did not make Carmi, who is the protagonist, the chef, an addict. I mean, he's dealing with some codependency issues, which I think is so interesting to talk about.
And by the way, just for listeners, he's a young guy who's taken over his brother's kitchen in a restaurant.
He comes back to Chicago after being at a kitchen that is so clearly made into being 11 Madison Park in New York City. And he's simultaneously trying to hold up the family business, prove himself, find a path forward, deal with incredible amounts of grief. And he does it in a way that is so not obvious, right? Like, there's no blatant sexual harassment. He has a sous chef that is played by Ayo, what's her last name? Edibiri, I think.
Who is a local actor.
Unbelievable. She's unreal. And they give her own personality, her own storyline, her own life. She's not just there to be hit. She's never hit on. They don't have any sort of sexual relationship. So refreshing. Because you always see that's just like, it's a crutch that it goes to, you know, they don't do it, which is great. There's definitely abuse, and there's, you know, trying to handle the pressure of the kitchen that you see through Jeremy's character. But, you see all of these things kind of come together in a way that doesn't – he's not an alcoholic, and he's not, you know, hitting on someone, and he's dealing with the pressure in a different way. Does it come out well? No. Is he handling it well? No. But they didn't take shortcuts, and they didn't take cheap shots.
So we were just talking about the Hulu series, The Bear, there with Tiffany Faison, who's here in Studio 2. I'm going to go back in time a little bit now, because the last time you were here, you were getting ready to throw out the first pitch at Fenway Park on Pride Night.
Got it across the plate.
You did. You were getting ready. So I want you to bear with me, because I want listeners to come back to that day and understand the journey. So here's what you told us that day about how you were feeling about it.
I can't even process what tonight is and what, like, I've been letting it kind of come in waves, or else I think it's just going to overwhelm me to the point of either not being able to function or crying or something. You know, I'm just trying to let it in little pieces, little bites at a time. And it's every time I let myself think about it, I just think,
I can't believe this is my life.
So then you throw out the first pitch that night, accompanied by drag queens Sassination, Coleslaw, and Pamela Manderson.
Here to throw out a ceremonial first pitch, please welcome Tiffany Faison.
Crazy.
All right, Tiffany, how about a pitch?
So crazy.
Okay, but then the next morning, yeah, your Twitter feed, yep, says, last night I had one of my favorite life moments surrounded by the love and support of my sweet friends. This morning, I woke up to a bunch of hateful BS comments. Mm-hmm. So, and I want to note for listeners that you weren't frowning until I got to that line. You were beaming until I got to that line, which tells me that those hateful comments couldn't take away from you.
No. I mean, they exist in two separate boxes for me. This moment that will never, ever be diminished or dimmed was such an extraordinary moment of my life. People don't get that. I still can't, but like, you played the audio and I just can't, I still can't believe it. It was just unbelievable. And there wasn't any second in that experience that I didn't understand exactly where I was and what was happening and what we were doing. And the privilege and the honor that I felt to be there was just next level. I live in a admittedly self-created bubble. I know that there's homophobia out there. I know that it's in the world. I live in Boston. I travel to New York and LA and, you know, usually larger cities, and I don't feel it that much. And so I don't really have people come for me and call me, you know, a dyke or say that I'm a groomer or my friends are groomers, or I don't experience that from day to day. I don't think it's a positive thing to experience, but it was a little bit of a wake-up call to kind of pop the bubble and understand that even in the region and the area and the country that we live in that feels pretty protected, there's still stuff.
Well, yeah, and the reason I really wanted to bring it up, and I appreciate you letting me, is because, I mean, just last week we had drag performer Patty Bure here, yep, on the show after performing Drag Queen Story Hour in JP and being protested by neo-Nazis.
What is happening? What is happening? This door that has been opened that has, and let's not pretend that people weren't there, right? There have always been neo-Nazis. There have been white supremacists. And by that, I mean disgusting racists. It's always been there. There's been homophobes. There's just, you know, I think 5 or so years ago, we had a door open and it permitted people to come out and to express that in a way that is less shameful than it used to be. I don't understand it. I never will. I'm going to continue to fight against it at every turn. I think for me, you know, and I so appreciate the Red Sox and the support of them and Nesson. For me, the difficulty, aside from the obvious conversation that was happening online and the abuse, was, you know, it's and the gay community talks about this, the queer community talks about this a lot, that in June, like, everyone's, you know, logo gets turned into a pride flag, and then, you know, July 1st is like, who, you know, like, we barely knew you. And I think, you know, I'm in conversation with the Red Sox and with Nesson and want to continue to talk to them about this, but I don't think you just get to a wash your logo in rainbows and then not deal with the fallout of it. And so I think it's important to have the conversation of, okay, it happened, but what's next? Because for me, when I was young, I think when you're in any way experiencing something that is not the mainstream in your life, and I'll speak for queer people, even before I could put a name to it, I knew I was different in a way that things that were talked about around the gay community, around lesbians, around queer people, I had an antenna up for that I didn't even understand why at the time. And so what scares me, or I think sticks with me the most and bothers me, is that I know that there's, you know, a young queer kid somewhere that is following the Red Sox, is playing softball or baseball or whatever it is, and had a moment or was there and said, this is freedom and this feels good and this is possible and I can, you know, unclench my jaw and let my shoulders down a little bit, and then saw that the next morning. And all of that conversation that was allowed on, you know, Nesson and Red Sox social media, it says to that kid, it's not safe and it's not okay and you're not okay. And none of that is true. There are no out MLB players, right? So until that is not the case, I think it is really important that we protect those spaces and make sure that the hateful speech is not part of mainstream communication for, you know, whether it's NFL, MLB, NBA, whatever it is, that we allow kids to grow up in and know that they can come out and play professional sports and be in any environment and be safe.
All right. There will be so much more for us to talk about, yeah. but we get to do this again.
Yes.
So for now, Boston restaurateur, culinary star Tiffany Faison, great to have you.
So nice to be here, Tiziana. Thank you.
Jyoti flies across the world to see her family in India. But India is so different from home. And Jyoti is lonely.
That is local author Rajini Laraka of Concord reading from her children's book, All Go and Come Back. Doctor, mother, author, Indian-American woman, Laraka has many identities, and she uses her own experiences to help kids and young adolescents find their own sense of who they are and belonging. Rajini Laraka joins us now here in Studio 2. Rajini, welcome.
Thank you so much, Tiziana. I'm excited to be here.
It's great to have you, and I enjoyed reading your books. I want to ask you, all those identities, who are you first and foremost?
Wow. I'm a human being. I think that's the most important thing. I think that I grew up wondering what I was really, whether I was Indian or American, and feeling like I had to choose, or feeling like maybe there was no place in the world where I really belonged. Then I grew up and wanted to go into medicine, but also loved reading and writing. Ended up majoring in government in college, even though
because
I was
of course.
Because, of course, because I needed to, I figured it was the only time I was going to get to study that before I went to medical school. Then went to medical school, got married, became a mother, and kind of came back to writing after many years of being a doctor. And so, yeah, none of us is one thing. And that's what I want to tell children, is that we all have multiple identities and we don't have to choose between them. We can be all of those things.
You know, we heard a little bit from I'll Come and Go right there at the top. We'll come back to that one. It's more recent than the one I want to talk about now, but I'm holding Red, White, and Whole, which is a middle grade book. I have become such a huge fan of middle grade books when we do them here on the show, because they just speak to the heart of kids at such a formative time. And it feels, Rajini, like you took all that, all the things, and found a way in this story to put them all together. So there's an element of medicine, and there's an element of girlhood, and there's elements of striding two worlds. So tell us a little bit about Raya, the main character.
Yes. So Red, White, and Whole is set in 1983, and it's about a 13-year-old girl named Reha who feels torn between the worlds of her Indian immigrant parents and their community and her friends in school who are mainly white.
And you and I may have both been 13 in 1983.
Yay! So it was a good time to be a teenager.
There is no time that is a good time to be a teenager.
So, you know, like most teenagers, Reha just wants to wear cool clothes, listen to awesome music, and go to a middle school dance. But her parents, and especially her mother, whom she calls Amma, they feel like she has better things to do with her time. So Reha is struggling with this when her mother is diagnosed with a kind of blood cancer called leukemia, and Reha's world is turned upside down. And she feels that if she could just be the perfect daughter, the daughter that her parents want her to be, that she can somehow save her mother's life.
And when I see her say that or think that the first time in the book, and I'm like, oh, no, sweetie, no, you know, you can't. But before we do that, let's actually have you read this little bit. This is from the section called The Treatment. And I want to point out for listeners, this book is in verse.
Yes.
And so you're going to read a little bit there for us.
The Treatment. We finally find out what Amma has. Acute myeloid leukemia. Acute, because it happened very recently. Myeloid, for the type of white blood cell that's growing abnormally. Leukemia, because the abnormal blood cells have spilled into the blood. To treat it, Dr. Andrews will give Amma a medicine called chemotherapy. Chemo means chemicals. Therapy means treatment.
And in that section, Rajini, and we're speaking with local author Rajini Laraka from Concord, we really get this intersection of all of your identities, because that is how I imagine a doctor would explain something so hard to a kid who shouldn't have to get that news but does. And you've said in other interviews that there's something autobiographical about Reha for you. So what does it mean to bring all of, and your mom, right? In fact, I think our kids are very close in age. What does it mean to bring all of those pieces together in a story? And who are you talking to? Who do you want to absorb this book.
Yeah. I'm talking to anybody who's ever had to deal with difficult news and has struggled to understand it, which is pretty much everyone.
Yeah.
So when I was a teenager, my mom didn't have cancer, but she was injured in a car accident. And I already knew that I wanted to go into medicine. But my mom had a traumatic brain injury and was in the hospital for weeks. And when that happened, I couldn't walk into a hospital without feeling sick to my stomach. Mm. Just the smell of it, it was so visceral to me. And I really had to second guess whether I wanted to go into medicine, because I was like, if I can't even walk into a hospital, what am I doing thinking about going to be a doctor? Now, obviously, that is something that I got through. And, you know, in order to write this book, I channeled that experience of being a child who was interested in science and interested in medicine specifically, who had to deal with being the loved one of somebody going through a terrible medical experience. And so I tried to use my medical knowledge, but to pare it down so that a child or somebody who is not medical, even an adult who wasn't medical, could understand what exactly was going on. And Reha struggles with the same thing that I struggled with. Now, obviously, in my life, I figured it out. I got through it, and I ended up going to medicine, and I love being a doctor. But I wanted to freeze that moment where Reha is not sure what she wants to do.
Because she thinks she wants to be a doctor, but she gets sick at the sight of blood.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I did wonder, okay, so obviously she's not real, but does she ever get over it? Does she become a doctor?
Oh, you know, I get questions like this all the time. I don't know. For me, Reha is frozen at the end of this book. But I hope so. I hope so. I do not faint at the sight of blood like Reha does, but that was very interesting. When I was writing that part of the book, I felt like Reha was over my shoulder saying, by the way, I faint at the sight of blood. Mm. And I was like, oh, really?
Good to know.
That's going to be hard, kid.
All right. So I want to point out, so we're talking with Concord author Rajini LaRocca. We've been talking about the book Red, White, and Whole from 2021. It's a middle grade book, but you also write, I would say, sort of more firmly children's books. So we heard a little bit from your book, I'll Go and Come Back, at the top. I don't have that one here, but I have read it. And I want to come back to that one because here's what struck me. Well, tell people what it's about to start.
I'll Go and Come Back is a story about a little girl named Jyothi who goes to visit her extended family in India and feels lonely and homesick. But then her grandmother, whom she calls Patti, makes her feel at home through stories and food and shopping. And then in the second half of the book, the grandmother goes to visit Jyothi in the United States and she feels lonely and homesick. And the little girl helps her grandmother. And the title is from a Tamil phrase. So we do not say goodbye. In Tamil, we say poitu varen, which means I'll go and come back. So there's always this promise of return.
So what struck me about it, reading it alongside another one of your books called Where Three Oceans Meet, is there's a wonderful love of intergenerational relationships, really among women and families, the grandmother, the mother, the daughter. And, you know, when I was little, I lived in an apartment and my grandmother had an apartment in our house and I lived in her apartment inside the house. I had that experience. And there is something magical for a little girl about having all those generations. Did you have that?
So, you know, traditionally, my family, there are multiple generations living together. But because my parents immigrated to the U.S., we were the only ones in the U.S. for a very long time. So to visit my grandmother, who was my only living grandparent for most of my life, we had to go all the way to India. And but I had cousins who lived with her. I had, you know, aunts and uncles and all kinds of people who were in India. So when we went to visit, we got a lot of bang for our buck. We saw a lot of people. Those times with my grandmother were so precious. And I think one of the things that was just an amazing experience for me was recognizing and understanding that my grandmother was a person. Like, she wasn't just my grandmother. She had had a whole life before I came along. And listening to her tell stories about that was incredible to me. So that is a thread that runs through many of my books, is intergenerational love, and especially mother to daughter to grandmother.
So there's a lot of cultural depth to your books? Are you writing for an Indian American audience? Are you writing for a broader audience? How are you thinking about that?
I hope that I'm writing for anybody who loves stories. But I will say that growing up as an Indian American in the U.S., I never read a book where I felt myself reflected in the story, not in the U.S. and not in India, because those stories were about Indian people in India. And I didn't read a book like that until I was an adult. And when I did, it was world-changing for me. That was Jhumpa Lahiri's The Namesake.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So I understand what it means to see yourself specifically reflected in a book. But also, as somebody who grew up in the U.S. and who loved all kinds of stories about all kinds of different people, I also know that the story doesn't have to be about somebody exactly like you in order for you to love it. So I hope that my books are for everyone. But yes, I hope that Indian American kids especially see themselves in these stories.
So some of your books, I'll come and I'm going to get the last part of it wrong, so bail me out again. I'll go and come back.
Yes.
Bracelets for Bina's Brothers, Where Three Oceans Meet. We've talked about Red, White, and Whole. Just in 20 or 30 seconds, you brought us a couple of books you'd recommend. Give us a couple of titles.
Oh, yes. Okay. So for the immigrant experience, I would recommend Unsettled by Reem Farooqi. It's about a Pakistani-American girl who moves to Georgia. It's also written in verse. Lovely. Mm-hmm. Another book that I absolutely loved is one called Stand Up, Yumi Chung by Jessica Kim. And it is about a Korean-American girl who wants to be a stand-up comic.
It's
hilarious. It's amazing.
And one more.
And The Ocean Calls by Tina Cho and illustrated by Jess X. Snow. About a Korean girl who wants to be a diver like her grandmother, but she is scared of the ocean.
Fantastic. We'll have all those books on our website at radioboston.org. Rajini LaRocca, author of Red, White, and Whole and other books for children, doctor, writer. Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's take a step back to January. In fact, January 12th, to be exact, because that's the day that bulldozers finished clearing tents at the intersection of Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard in Boston. And that was in response to a growing housing crisis and an uptick of substance use there.
Well, the city came and they took it away. They demolished it. But it's funny, I had a lot of clothing and things like that in there, and it's just all gone.
That's Michael, who only wanted to be called by his first name, talking to WBUR reporter Deborah Becker at the time. The clearing had started that previous fall, when then-acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey declared a public health crisis. And over the course of several months, hundreds of people who called the area home moved or were forced out, their tents removed, like Ron Geddes.
I'm a man that tries to, you know, work hard and do what I'm supposed to do, and I don't want to be here no more than anybody else wants me here. I just don't want to live where they're asking me to. I don't have the money they're asking me for to rent a house or apartment where I grew up all my life. I just can't afford it.
Volunteer city workers like Massachusetts Health Commissioner Monica Burrell helped other residents pack their belongings.
You know, this is a fragile population that we're working with, and things change hour to hour, but people are cooperating. They understand what's happening today. They understand that we're looking for safe alternatives for them. That is the goal.
Some were headed to shelters. For others, like Jason Thompson, the future was unclear.
I'm trying to get into the first thing that's available. Anything that's available, I'm willing to go. I'm willing to give it a try. I'm going back down the street, hopefully. I'm going to sign up again. Hopefully I can get in a bed tonight somewhere. If not, I'll be back here.
The city has said more than 150 people who were living at the area known as Mass and Cass were relocated to permanent housing. The intersection had become a known open-air drug market, a place for prostitution, and an unsafe area for nearby businesses.
Well, we've had a situation, I'll speak for myself, you know, where, you know, somebody hits my car or is so high to can. I mean, they are so not in touch with who they are or where they are, whether that's in the middle of the street or on a sidewalk. They fall over. They're completely out. It's almost like they're unconscious, right? So that's occurring.
That's Catherine D'Amato of the Greater Boston Food Bank, which operates nearby. She was talking to us in September of 2021. But Massencast could also be a place of comfort for those who spent time there.
It is its own community with little sub-communities, because you got to remember there's Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, a couple of people that are Asian. There's a lot of white people and a lot of black people. So it's like all these sub-communities within this little community. It's like a city. It's almost like a city within a city.
That was Cabby, who didn't want to use his real name, talking with WBUR's Deb Becker. And for those, like Alex, who knew someone who did find comfort there.
There was that little bit of relief that, you know what, if he's there, he's safe. And it's not because I wanted him to go through, you know, any kind of pain or anything like that. I just wanted him to be alive.
It's been 7 months since the city took down tents on a wide scale. Now things in that area look eerily familiar.
So right now what you would see is roughly between 125, 175 people every day on the street on Southampton Street. A lot of the people on the street now are new. The people that were put in housing, a lot of them are still in housing or shelter, but out there now are people coming in from all over.
That's Sue Sullivan of the New Market Business Association. She and others continue to work to help those living at Massencast. She and interim Suffolk County District Attorney Kevin Hayden joined us just last week to talk about what we still need to do in the area.
We have to face the reality that we have a public health problem down on Massencast, but we also have a public safety problem as well. Violent crime this year down that area is up by about 9%. Compared to last year. And so that's got to concern everybody.
So last year, before the tents came down, we spoke with Brendan Little about solutions. He is the former policy director for the Mayor's Office of Recovery Services. He served under former Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, but he's also a formerly unhoused person. On Friday, we plan to check back in with Brendan on what's gone on since the area was cleared. But in preparation for that, we wanted to revisit our conversation with him from last year. And when we spoke, we started by asking Brendan Little what people lose, aside from their belongings, when tents are cleared away from Massencast.
I think it's really important to think about why people are on the street and who they're interacting with on a day-to-day basis. Oftentimes, people who are in Massencast, they've burnt many bridges in their life, or they've lost loved ones. And the people that are their strongest connection are their fellow peers on the street and also harm reduction workers, recovery outreach workers, both at the city and nonprofits in the area. And those people are sometimes the lifeline for them, often the lifeline for them to maintain their wellness. So I think that, you know, it's really important that when, you know, enacting any policies that have to do with moving people along, that you maintain those social connections. And it's really hard to do if it's not thought through and if it's not coordinated in a way that offers people dignity and, you know, wellness.
So why? Explain it to us, and maybe you can give us an example. Can people just not get in touch with each other? They can't reach each other anymore? Are they moved away? So illustrate that for us. Why is that so hard to preserve?
It's so hard to preserve because, you know, it's tricky to explain. I think there's, you know, there's so much down there. I think when people drive by or they, you know, they walk by or they see pictures on social media or in the media of Massencast, they don't want to look at it because it's too scary, you know, and I get it. It is scary. But as a person who was formerly unhoused, as a person in recovery, what I do get is that when all those other social connections are gone, the people that are on the street, you know, they're your lifeline, and they're the ones that are going, you know, they have your back. They are reversing each other's overdoses. They're looking out for each other with food and clothing. Oftentimes they work jobs, you know, various degrees, either under the table or officially. They're in relationships. So when you lose that setting, you know, that social setting, you break communities apart. So I think what's really important is that you offer people non-congregate low threshold shelter, like it has been talked about. And this is not a theory, you know, this is not something that is new to Boston. When COVID first hit, this was something that was enacted right away. And, you know, you had all these frontline staff who've been dealing with one pandemic all the epidemic. Now they're facing a whole other epidemic on top of that. So, you know, I think it's really important for me to lift up the frontline workers that are doing this work each day, as well as the people who have community and find community in that neighborhood each day.
You know, you come at this from a personal place. And I want to ask you, when did you become homeless and for how long were you unhoused?
So I first started running away from home when I was 13 years old and 14 years old. I first started sleeping on the street when I was 14 years old. And back then it was, you know, Mass Cass wasn't really the area where people congregated so much. It was Copley Square, it was Newberry Street, the Fenway area in Boston. And to me, you know, what I found there was a group of people who were into punk rock music like I was, people who numbed their pain with drugs and alcohol, but also people that were really caring, people that were really kind, people who were smart. Diverse communities, you know, people from all parts of the city. And then from there, I started getting involved with law enforcement, getting arrested for petty stuff, you know, drinking in public, truancy. That put me on the radar for DCF. Then it was called DSS and then DYS. So those basically the criminal justice system for youth, and the Department of Children and Families. And that kind of led me on a year of being in and out of various institutions. And then from there, got back home for a little while. Then from 16 to 18 years old, I was unhoused again, you know, staying on couches or sometimes staying on the street. And so, yeah, for me, it was really about even when I got housed eventually as a young adult, I still stayed very close to the people on the street because they were my community, you know, and I would still go out there and hang out and I would miss them. And I know that sounds strange to some people, but it's very common. You know, I met with a young person a few years ago who had housing in Cambridge and he wasn't sleeping in it. He was sleeping on the street because it felt so foreign to him and he didn't have his community. So I just think it's really important to highlight the community, not only of the people on the street, of the frontline harm reduction and recovery workers who are out there each day that, you know, don't take breaks, that are out there reversing overdoses, giving people food, warm clothes, and taking care of the people who many people overlook or have forgotten about.
So I want to ask you, you were policy director for the Office of Recovery Services in the Walsh administration. You left in January 2021.
Yes.
Is there something that the Walsh administration was doing that's not happening now? Was there a better job being done then?
I don't know. I think it's difficult to compare. You know, I'm not here to, you know, criticize anybody. I don't know what they're going through. I think the biggest thing that I want to lift up is that, you know, when I was there in January, there weren't, you know, 150 or 200 tents, you know, on the streets. I know that that's really challenging for people. For the harm reduction people, for the people doing the work, it's just, you know, it's a different challenge. It's a different beast. So it's kind of like comparing apples and oranges. But the thing I can say is that, you know, we invested heavily with Mayor Walsh, Jen Tracy, Devin Lark, and the team there, Marty Martinez, invested very heavily in an engagement center, which will be open in the next month or so, a brick and mortar engagement center, a street outreach team for the first time. Tripling the staff of the PATHS program, which, you know, places people in treatment, expanding harm reduction across the city. So, you know, that's something that I know I've done. But the way I think about it is, you know, I was a policy director, which is a fancy title, but it didn't matter what I was doing if the frontline people on the street, you know, the Sarah Mackins and the Teresas and all the people that I worked with who are the harm reductionists, the tried and true people on the street, if they were telling me, you know, that stuff wasn't working, those were the people I listened to,
Brendan,
because their ear were to the street.
So I'm sure you're aware that the ACLU of Massachusetts is now suing the city over these moves to move people out of tents and temporary shelters. I know during the Walsh administration, Operation Clean Sweep was the summer of 2019, just before the pandemic. Deep criticism of the actions of the Boston Police Department there, where over a two-day period, they arrested dozens of people and cleared out possessions, et cetera. What role should law enforcement have? And did the Walsh administration do the wrong thing with Clean Sweep? Is there any way that law enforcement should be involved in this picture?
I think that law enforcement should be involved to some extent. I think Clean Sweep was deeply traumatic for the people who are on the street, but also for the frontline workers, because it was just, from what I understand, it was a really brash, quick decision based on an altercation with a corrections officer and somebody on the street. So it was very quick. Staff were detained, you know, frontline staff were detained for hours without being told what was going on. So I think that there's a role, and I think that the police street outreach team did some very good work when they were first online. You know, these were officers who directly worked with people, drove them to treatment. You know, some of them were even giving haircuts, you know, really kind of, again, emphasizing this social bond, social connection. I'm not sure if that's happening now, but I think that, you know, there's a role for law enforcement, but I think you can't lead with law enforcement. You know, I've seen harm reduction workers, street outreach workers, you know, keep peace and maintain public safety better than I've seen police who can sometimes agitate situations. I'm not saying that's always the case, but I have seen that happen.
So last question for you, Brendan. Most people listening to this are far, both in terms of distance and lived experience, from what we're talking about here. You're not. What is the most important thing you want people to take away from this conversation?
That there's so many people out there who are doing the work every single day, you know, and they've been doing it for years and years and years since before there was a mass cast moniker that everybody knew, that there are tried and true people out there who are doing the work, taking care of people, and that the area is so stigmatized. But I just want you to know that the people who are there are people. They're so diverse, and they have incredible backgrounds, and they're smart, and they're caring, and the same for the frontline staff. And also, we need to invest both on the front end, which is, you know, low threshold services and harm reduction services to help people who are in active use build trust. And then on the back end, once people are in recovery, we need to give them the economic supports so that they can maintain recovery. Because if there's no reason to get in recovery to have a purpose-driven life, you won't do it. And I think that the front end and the back end are really where we need to invest as a city and a state.
That was Brendan Little. He is the former policy director for the Mayor's Office of Recovery Services, and that was under former Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. He also spent time unhoused. Much of the sound we used today is from the great reporting of WBUR's own Deborah Becker and from interviews here on Radio Boston. And a note that the engagement center that Brendan referred to in that conversation was temporarily closed in late April and has not reopened.